coming up on Philosophy Talk.
No one is born hating another person.
Why we hate?
No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin, or his background, or his religion. People must learn to hate.
Is hatred always a bad thing?
Isn't it appropriate to hate hateful people?
How is hate different from anger or contempt?
Your eyes are full of hate. That's good. Hate keeps a man alive. It gives him strength.
And I get sick when I'm around. I can't stand to be around. I hate everything about you.
I hate you. I hate you.
Our guest is Britt Brogard, author of Hatred, Understanding Our Most Dangerous Emotion.
I hate you? I don't even know you, but I hate you too.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
On Wednesday, May 3rd, join us at the Stanford Humanities Center for a live recording of Philosophy Talk.
We'll be asking, Can Art Save Us? With Harriet Hawkins from the University of London.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Wednesday, May 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Stanford Humanities Center.
Can't wait to see you there.
Why is there so much hate in the world?
Is hatred ever morally justified?
Or does hate just breed more hate?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective COVID-free homes via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about why we hate.
That's a tragically timely subject, Ray. We've got a serious problem with hate in it. I just think it's getting worse by the day.
Yeah, I agree that we have a serious problem with hate groups and hate crimes. But I don't think that hatred itself is necessarily a bad thing.
Really? You're saying there's a good kind of hate?
Well, yeah. I mean, I hate racism and injustice and inequality. And I think it's good to hate those things. I also hate my toaster. It always burns the toast. I wouldn't call that good hate, but it's not bad. Oh, and don't tell me you don't hate The Bachelor. I know you do.
Okay, yeah, all right, guilty as charged about The Bachelor. But you're talking about abstract ideas like racism or inanimate objects like your toaster. I'm talking about people, hating groups of people. That's something we really need to stamp out.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, think of some of the worst people from history. Dictators who slaughtered thousands. Shouldn't we hate those kinds of people?
Well, look, we should certainly condemn them. We should fight back against everything they do. But do we need to hate them? I just don't see how adding more hate in the world is going to solve anything.
Even if you were right, Josh, do we really have that much control over how we feel? Especially how we feel about senseless violence?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. We can't always control how we feel. But maybe we can control what we do and what we say. Acting out of hate, that's just never a good thing.
Never say never. I mean, don't you think that our hatred can sometimes motivate us to do good things for the world? Like fighting for change and stopping injustices from happening ever again.
I'm all for fighting for change. I just think we need to find a way to do that without hating other people. Maybe that kind of hatred can start out benevolent and everything, but I just worry it's eventually going to lead to disaster.
Well sure. If you're hating people for their race or religion or gender or sexuality, like that's definitely bad. But hating people for being part of a hate group, using slurs, advocating violence, that's completely appropriate. Those people deserve to be hated.
Even if they deserve to be hated, I'm just not sure it's a good idea to hate them. The costs are too high.
What costs?
Well, if you hate, you're hurting yourself. You're carrying around a poison that's eating you up from within.
Yeah, that's great for you, but that lets other people off the hook. Maybe it's all zen and groovy not to carry around hate for white supremacist groups, but we're kind of going to need you to take that hit.
But why? Why can't I just condemn them, fight to change their minds, and strive for a society that's free from their bigotry?
Because your very hatred is what's going to bring that about. They've got to suffer a social cost. That's the only thing that can make a difference.
I don't know, Ray. I just think all hatred does is sow division and distrust, increase polarization, and make oppression, intimidation, and violence more likely.
Okay. So what do you think is the best way to stop the bad kind of hate?
Well, in just a moment, we're going to ask our guest, Barrett Brogard from the University of Miami, whose new book is called Hatred, Understanding Our Most Dangerous Emotion.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shireen Adil, to find out why some people might actually foster hate in order to find community. She files this report.
Who do you hate, Danny?
I hate anyone that isn't white Protestant.
This is a clip from the 1998 movie American History X.
Why?
They're a burden to the advancement of the white race. Some of them are all right, I guess.
None of them are all right, Danny, okay?
They're making a video to spread their message and recruit new members to their white supremacist group.
The dehumanizing language is kind of really defining the out-group.
And that's Peter Simi, professor of sociology at Chapman University. He's been studying hate and extremism for 25 years.
There's also this really extraordinarily high level of in-group preference. So you see a lot of kind of the opposite language used to describe your group, right? You're a special kind of people. You have special qualities.
And for these groups, the message might be religious, they were chosen by God, or they believe they're biologically superior, or, especially recently, that they're more culturally advanced.
So you hear a lot of discussion now with like the Proud Boys and whether they're a hate group or not. I tend to think they are. And one of the things that defines them, I would say, as a hate group is their cultural ethnocentrism and superiority.
The Southern Poverty Law Center also calls the Proud Boys a hate group. It's one of 940 in the U.S. as of 2019, not far from the all-time high of 1,020 in 2018.
2016 had a really emboldening effect on a lot of groups.
Simi says one of the main reasons that is that the president uses the same kind of language that hate groups do.
Democrats love open borders. Let the whole world come in. Let the whole world, MS-13, gang members from all over the place, come on in. We have open borders.
And it really does sound uncomfortably similar to another scene from American History X, that movie we heard earlier.
Every night, thousands of these parasites stream across the border like some pinata exploded.
So even when President Trump says he will condemn white supremacists...
What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
White supremacists and
would
white
you like me to condemn?
White Proud Boys.
What he actually says is easily interpreted as a signal of support.
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
Though language is central to understanding how hate groups work, Simi says there are other important factors that lead people to join them.
Anytime there's a major economic downturn, you get anxiety, you get fear, you get anger. People are looking to scapegoat. So that certainly played a role.
But then there are also factors that lead people to leave them.
It's a pretty common occurrence because these groups are so demanding in many respects. They have a high burnout rate.
In fact, if you look back over many years, you can see that the groups themselves fizzle out and then rise again. And those same years where we see peak hate group activity, like 2011, 2018, and even today, we also see widespread protests against economic inequality, systemic racism, and police violence.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shireen Adil.
Thank you for that fascinating report, Shireen. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about why we hate.
We're joined now by Barrett Brogard, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Miami and author of Hatred, Understanding Our Most Dangerous Emotion. Britt, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here again.
So Britt, last time you were on the show, you were talking about your book about love. Now you've got a new book about hatred. So what happened in between?
Oh, that's complicated. But there was an election taking place, among other things. But more generally speaking, we've seen an increase, a rise in hatred in America. And since I already dealt with personal hate a little bit in the love book, I thought that I would look into its counterpart.
When Josh and I were talking before, we actually never defined what hate is. How would you define it, Britt?
Yeah, that's complicated. There are many different forms of hatred. And you are right when you said that there is such a thing as hating your toaster or hating your MacBook Air or hating a certain fact or hating an ideology. But that's hatred of entities or principles or facts. And in that sense, it means something like strong dislike. And that's a little bit different from the kind of hate that we want to eradicate. The kind of hate that we talk about is on the rise, which is hate of persons, either or usually people who belong to a particular group.
So what's special about hatred of people as opposed to inanimate objects or concepts?
So when you hate a person, you can think about anger as a starting point. So if you take anger, then you can be angry with someone who stepped on your toes or stole your lunchbox. So the anger is about something they did wrong. It's not about their personality or character. Hate is holistic, so it's also about, or mostly about, the person's character or personality traits. So you are basically, by hating someone, you are holding an attitude towards them that conveys in some way that they have malicious traits of sorts.
Okay, so and what's the difference between hatred then and contempt?
Yeah, it's a very good question. In ordinary speech, we talk about hate mail, for example. And certainly if you said something out of contempt to me in a piece of mail that you sent me, or you said something hateful to me, we would still call it hate mail and we wouldn't speak of contempt mail. But that's because there are two senses, more than two, but at least two senses of hate in the English language. One is a broad sense, where it means hate or contempt, as in hate mail. In hate group might be the same. And then there's a narrow sense, which is what we talk about when we talk about personal hate. Specifically, we have that in mind. Contempt, just to add one thing, has a disgust element and a disrespect element that hate in the narrow sense does not.
So wait, are you saying I can hate somebody without disrespecting them?
Not really, actually. It gets complicated. So the disrespect is actually shared in common between hate and contempt. But in hatred, we actually have a different kind of respect. It sounds very strange, but let me explain. We have some respect for the people we hate. What kind of respect do we have? Well, it's a kind of apprehensive respect. It's the kind of respect you have if you say, I respect the sea, or I have respect for this slope that's very icy. So it's a kind of fear. And you might just say, okay, it's just apprehension or fear, but it is showing up in the English language as respect. And that is also the kind of respect that can almost turn to admiration. So if you have seen some of the latest Ted Bundy TV shows on Netflix, some of them show that he had a lot of fans and women admiring him. And that kind of admiration is sort of one step up from what I'm talking about that fear or apprehension or apprehensive respect that we have for the people we hate. So it cancels out the disrespect a little bit. So you're talking down to a person when you contempt them in some sense, right? If you're contempt speaking to them, if you're hating them, you're sort of, you want to punish them or kick them or something like that.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about why we hate with Berit Brogard from the University of Miami, author of Hatred, Understanding Our Most Dangerous Emotion.
Is it always wrong to hate? Or are there some people who deserve to be hated? Can hate ever serve a good cause?
Hating haters and strife creators. Plus comments and questions from you, our listeners, when Philosophy Talk continues. Cause you're dead to me. 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 If your enemies are dead to you, can you still really hate them? I'm Josh Landy. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about why we hate with Barrett Brogard from the University of Miami, author of Hatred, Understanding Our Most Dangerous Emotion.
With COVID having reached the highest office in the land, we're still pre-recording episodes from the safety of our respective basements, so I'm afraid we can't take your phone calls today. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can also become a subscriber, gaining access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So Britt, earlier Josh was saying that it might be okay to hate inanimate objects or abstract ideas, but that we should never hate other people. And I said that some people are truly hateful and they deserve to be hated. So who do you think is right?
I think you're right.
Yes.
There are people who deserve to be hated. Hate plays the kind of role that you were talking about. That's actually exactly one of the things I'm arguing in the book. But the thing about suffering social consequences is a function of emotions that are sort of thought of as good moral emotions when they can function that way. But of course, there are constraints on what kind of hatred can function that way.
So what are the constraints?
So I argue that when hatred becomes dehumanizing, then it cannot be justified. And when hatred is associated with retaliation, it cannot be justified. So I argue that you actually do need to hate occasionally to spark social change, but not in a dehumanizing way and not in a way where you're seeking retaliation.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And I have to say, you know, speaking in my own voice, I totally see the advantage for society of people getting called out for stuff. But what do you say to the argument on the other side, according to which hatred is bad for the hater, for the individual, that it comes at a certain cost? Bernice King, the daughter of Martin Luther King, tweeted just this week a quote from her dad, "Hate is too great a burden to bear." And so there seems to be a fairly widespread view, at least, that, well, maybe it has some good effects, but we'd sort of be better off as individuals without it. It's not good for me to have that kind of poison inside my soul. Well, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so it becomes a poison when it's a form of dehumanizing hatred. I call the other form of hatred critical hatred. And it can also be a form of poison when you have retaliatory wishes or desires, so that definitely can eat you up from the inside. But hatred can also be healing in certain circumstances.
I wanted to ask about retaliation. So you might think it's one thing to want to retaliate against somebody and another thing to actually do it. And so I see why it's bad to actually do it, but it seems like it's often totally fine to want to do things that you shouldn't do in real life as long as you keep a hold of yourself and a hold of reality. But it sounds like you think even wanting to retaliate is bad. Can you say more about why that is?
Yeah, so there is such a thing as cognitive dissonance. And without getting into the details of that, it's basically an uncomfortable contradiction you have in you, not necessarily conscious to you, but say you hate and love the same person. In the case of where you have retaliatory desires, you have a kind of contradiction inside of you. And let me explain why that is. I think that if you are a fairly good person, you will agree with me that we should not use other people as mere means to an end. But retaliation is, in some sense, using another person as a mere means to an end, namely your own selfish end, your own desire to retaliate. So in the case where you do retaliate, that would be morally indefensible. In the case where you just have the desire, we can talk about it being irrational in the sense of there being cognitive dissonance.
I think I'm still a little confused about why the desire is wrong, because it seems like I often have perfectly okay desires to do things that I shouldn't do. So I would like to eat a whole chocolate cake. I often feel that way about chocolate cake. And if I did it, that would be, I mean, it wouldn't be morally wrong, but it'd be like really impractical because I'd get a stomach ache. And I would prevent myself from eating more nutritious things that I probably need more. But I'm not sure I'm ready to give up the desire to do that.
Me neither.
Yeah.
If you desire to eat a cake and you desire to lose weight or you desire to keep your diet, then you definitely have the kind of conflict that might qualify for cognitive dissonance. You could have worse contradictions, such as, well, I want my loved one who is terminally ill to live, but I also want them to die so their suffering could end. In the case of retaliatory desires, I'm thinking that if you're at least an average person, maybe even sort of a good person, you don't want to use other people as tools to the satisfaction of your own desires. So you have a desire not to retaliate because retaliation is using them to satisfy your retaliatory desires. And you also have the desire to retaliate. So that's a contradiction. So I'm not saying that having the desire is immoral. I'm just saying that it's irrational.
Can I push you a little tiny bit more on this? Because I'm also confused about the means to an end aspect of your answer. So it seems like it's not obvious to me that if I want to retaliate against somebody, I'm using them as a means to the end of like my satisfaction. So suppose that they've hurt a defenseless person that I sort of want recognized, and I retaliate on behalf of the defenseless person. Isn't that about the defenseless person and not about me?
It might be in that particular case, but if you set up the case the way that you want it to be, then you don't have. If you really just work as in the service of the other person, you don't have a retaliatory desire. You're retaliating, but you're not really retaliating. You're doing it for the other. So it's the other person who's retaliating through you. You're like kind of like the hitman, right? So that might be another thing that you're doing that's wrong. But it's the real person who has the retaliatory desire is the one who's setting you up. If you are retaliating, even if it's like as small of an issue as asking your classmate to give you back the book that you lent them because they did something to you that you think is really bad. That's retaliation, right? And that's not something that can be justified if you agree with me that we should not treat people as mere means to an end. So we can treat people as means to an end, but not as mere means to an end.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about Why We Hate with Berit Brogard from the University of Miami, author of Hatred, Understanding Our Most Dangerous Emotion. And we have a comment from Alfredo, who wrote on our website, philosophytalk.org, more than 70 years after World War II, few topics stir such heated conversations in France as the collaborator versus resistant debate. In 2008, the Bibliothèque de Paris hung the work of André Zucca on its walls. The pictures depicted ordinary Parisians going about their daily lives under the occupation. It was a scandal. It seemed the passive citizen drew almost as much hate as the collaborator. So what do you think, Berit? Should we hate bystanders as much as perpetrators?
I don't think we should hate them as much. I think that they are accountable, but that accountability comes in degree. And accountability or blame, rather, is a part of hatred, actually, as I define it. So I think that I agree that we should hold both accountable. I argue that in the book. A passive bystander should still be held accountable for things that go on in front of their noses.
That makes sense. And I have to say, I really like the set of distinctions you were making earlier, that, you know, trying to sort out what's the good kind of hatred, the bad from the bad kind. Don't dehumanize, maybe don't retaliate, make your hatred sensitive to reasons, things like this, things that you talk about in your book. I want to come back, though, to your really interesting thought about the healing kind of hatred. You had this lovely passage in your book about double consciousness. And am I understanding you right that the thought is something like, look, if you don't hate your oppressor, if you react to your oppressor's hatred of you with just okay, or well, I see what you mean, or something short of full-blown hatred, maybe you're not doing everything you can to assert your self-respect. Is it kind of a Fanon style thought here? I've got to hate the oppressor. In those conditions, hatred is not only warranted but good for the oppressed person.
Yeah, it's interesting because actually a lot of civil rights activists made that very point without necessarily naming it as hatred. But James Baldwin, for example, in some of his short stories, where he brilliantly sets up the racist as the character, right, that you normally should emphasize with, but instead you're feeling some kind of disgust. But there's one scene in Going to Meet the Man, one of his short stories, where finally some of the civil rights protesters, they're standing up to this white deputy racist and looking at them with hatred in their eyes. And that's exactly what you're talking about. And that, I think, is important when you leave out the violence and when you leave out the dehumanization and when you leave out the retaliation. You're simply just, in that particular situation, reasserting your status.
So how do you keep this healing kind of hatred from turning into the bad or dangerous or corrosive kind of hatred?
Yeah, that's difficult, right? Martin Luther King Jr. said that all the time, that you have to really work on protesting without violence, right? And speaking up, but don't kill or don't hit people and so on. So the good trouble is something you have to work on. It's definitely difficult to hate without feeling the desire to retaliate. Sure, we all slide into that all the time if we hate someone, especially if it's a personal kind of hatred.
You said something earlier, I think, about the possibility of love coexisting with hatred. Is that related to avoiding the desire to retaliate?
That's interesting. I think that it's a fact that it does coexist. In the book, I sort of consider, can it coexist? And I'm considering love in this case not as a kind of new romantic love infatuation, but more like the kind of love you have for a long-term partner or a friend or a child or something like that. And then can you also have hatred at the same time? Or is that actually also an inconsistency? Is that irrational? And it turns out, yes, it is irrational, because the kind of love that I am describing in the book is the kind of love where you want to promote the other person's interests, but in hatred, even if you don't want to stand in the way of the other person's interests. You don't exactly want to promote the other person's interests. So there's a clash.
Okay, so but yeah, I'm a literature person. So, you know, as soon as you say, can love and hate coexist? I'm like, yeah, every sonnet.
Exactly.
I think especially of Shakespeare's Sonnet 35, where the speaker's boyfriend has betrayed him, perhaps sexually, it's not clear. And he describes this as love and hate. Such civil war is in my love and hate. Couldn't that be rational in a certain way, right? You know, you love the person and your love doesn't just magically go away because you were betrayed. But on the other hand, you got betrayed.
Actually,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, doesn't it kind of fall into the kind of definition you were saying earlier? You respect the person and yet you see something a bit dubious in their character. And right, and you target a certain kind of negative emotion that way. What do you think?
I mean, we can understand it. And it may also be that it's rational in the sense of being in your own self-interest, so prudential. Mm-hmm. So that's one sense of rational, that something is in your own interest. But if the content of your mind contains a contradiction about something that matters to you, then we would say, at least in philosophy, we would say that you are irrational.
So if I love and hate somebody at the same time, should I stop loving them or stop hating them? Or does it depend on what they did?
I think it definitely depends on what they did. It also depends on, that's another way that hatred can be irrational. And that's if it doesn't fit the world or the circumstances. So if you are wrong about hating the other person, if you're just taking something that person did and attributing that to their bad character, then you are wrong and you should stop hating. So it also depends on you, as well as, of course, on what they really did.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about why we hate with Berit Brogard from the University of Miami, author of Hatred: Understanding Our Most Dangerous Emotion.
What can we do to stem the tide of hatred? Do we need stiffer penalties for hate crimes? Better education? Are there changes we can make to the political system?
Abating Hate, plus commentary from Ian Scholes, a 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. If haters gonna hate, aren't there better solutions than just shaking it off? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Berit Brogard from the University of Miami, and we're thinking about why we hate.
And we have an email from Carl in Portland, Oregon. Carl says, hate is much different than simple intense aversion. It's really a hidden fear-based reaction to stimuli that may even be unconscious for the creator. Thanks for that really great thought, Carl. Now, Britt, I think we can all agree that the proliferation of hate groups is a really terrible and worrying development, but it's harder to know how to combat that. Do you have any suggestions for the changes that we can make?
Yes. I think that we should consider a different kind of hate speech legislation than what has been on the table and has been rejected. It's a different form from the one that you see in Europe. So that's one proposal I have. But hate speech legislation is only going to take us so far. I think that another thing that we should do is that we should change our voting system. So there are other voting systems that some are already actually in effect in smaller areas of the country. One is called ranked choice voting. And then that's another system that I'm working on developing with a psychologist. That would be a little bit different from our current voting system.
So can you say a little bit more about the connection between voting systems and hate?
Yeah, so the way that the voting system is set up, at least in at the federal level, in the presidential election, for example, you have a vote, right? And you vote for one candidate or the other. So the candidates just needs to cater to their base and maybe to the swing voters. But when you have ranked choice voting, so that would be, say that it works a little bit better with more candidates, but say you had five candidates and you can put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down, or maybe there are more, but you can rank your top five. In that case, one of the candidates may win on the basis of the second choice votes or the third choice votes. And so they can't just cater to their own base. In fact, they might have to cater to second choice voters, third choice voters, fourth choice voters. And so you don't see the kind of polarization, I would think, that you actually see today in politics. And we know that that is definitely encouraging some of the hatreds in the population. Sometimes it's also encouraging the hate groups in becoming more polarized.
So I have a question, I guess, about the possibilities and limits of that. So I spent some time in Australia, and I was living in Queensland, which is the home of racist MP Pauline Hanson, to pick on one notable Australian racist. And so I guess, yeah. I'm a little, so it doesn't seem like ranked choice voting eliminates hatred, which is not what you said. You said it would make the problem better, but I guess I think I'm a little bit like unsure about how much of a solution it is, especially in a country that also, has like real power differentials, between like white people and other, minority groups.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be difficult to. I'm not even talking about eliminating hatred. I'm talking about preventing it from increasing more. But even then, it's going to be difficult. There's another thing called group polarization, which is, in a nutshell, really that in a big group of people that are devoted to the same cause passionately. If they deliberate or debate over a certain amount of time, they might start out with moderate viewpoints, say they might sort of dislike immigrants, but then after they have talked for a certain amount of time, every single one in the group will be more radical than anyone in the group was when they started. So that's sort of the one of those interesting unpredictable findings about groups, that actually occurs. But it only occurs when people are devoted to a cause that they're very passionate about, or they are very similar-minded in some other way. So if we could actually break up these forums where similar-minded people get together to debate the same causes that they're very passionate about, that might help too. Of course, we can't completely break them up, but maybe we could do something about breaking them up. And I'm thinking mostly online in this case.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that brings me to a slightly more general question, not just how can we tackle it, but what are the causes of this? You've pointed to one very plausible cause, which is this kind of siloization, right? These filter bubbles, echo chambers that people find themselves in. One of the things I love about the way you write about hatred is you don't buy into the banality of evil claim. You don't believe it. I don't believe either.
Yeah, no, that,
right? We're all the same. We'd all become murderous killers. Just put us in that situation. So your thought isn't that, look, this is just how humanity is. Your thought is more, this is being artificially manufactured by propaganda, by badly functioning social media. What are some other features of our current landscape that are contributing to this terrifying rise of hate?
Well, so that goes into politics again a little bit, but there's a tendency to romanticize the past, but our past is a white supremacist past. So if you romanticize the past, you romanticize white supremacy. Make America great again. Well, what kind of past was that? What kind of past are we returning to in doing that? So that would be I call it the American fantasy with PH for various reasons, but it's sort of that very idea. But in addition to that, there's a lot of propaganda, political propaganda. I mean, now you might think of some poster during the years before the Second World War in Germany. When I say propaganda, but propaganda actually is everywhere. It can be as subtle, right, as a claim made about a certain rally. So, for instance, the Charlottesville rally, when Trump was talking about that both sides, so both the white supremacists and the counter protesters, that they were both to blame. Well, that's very subtle, but it's it tries to send a message, and it's kind of like part of a propaganda. And I could mention a lot of other examples of novels and so forth that have inspired the current administration.
So I agree with the points you're making about the connections between white supremacy and hate and propaganda. I'm wondering if you have views on like how much of white supremacy can be explained by hate, because you often hear this like, well, I'm not prejudiced because I don't hate the group that I'm supposedly prejudiced against. So like I'm not a racist. Like some of my best friends are black, or like I'm not sexist. I love women. Is that because there's more to things like white supremacy and misogyny than hate?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this goes back to what we started out talking about. It could be manifested as contempt, that where you're thinking, oh, they're not quite as good as you, right? That just is hate. But what about, can it be another way of looking at other people? Sure, you might have a form of contempt that would be disgust. That would be one down from contempt. You might be disgusted by some people. But clearly, yeah, there's more to it. You also have to hate them for a reason that's unreasonable, right? You're hating them, say, because of their skin color, or because of their gender, or because of their sexual orientation, or because of their cultural traditions or their religions or something like that. And so you're not hating them for a reason that could possibly rationally motivate hatred.
I wanted to hear more about your hate speech legislation proposal, actually, which you mentioned briefly. What kind of laws would do a better job of combating hate speech?
That's a hard question. I devote a whole chapter more or less to that. And I sort of engage with the idea that that has inspired a lot of the hate speech laws in Europe, and is also defended by Waldron in legal theorists who has a book defending hate speech as being a kind of defamation or libel. So the typical defamation case, that libel case that you might have, would be that someone writes, attributes some crime to you falsely in some newspaper, for example, or elsewhere, or in some public place. And that would be a typical defamation or libel case. And so he argues that it should be group libel, and a lot of the laws in Europe not define hate speech, but take hate speech to be a kind of group libel, and base that to the laws on that. But I what I'm arguing is that a lot of hate speech is not really at all group libel or any form of libel, because for something to be defamation, it has to be something that's factual, that's true or false. But if I call someone some slur, I have hardly made some factual claim false or true, so that doesn't work. But there are also much more subtle cases. There's Holocaust denial. Holocaust denial doesn't sound like defaming anyone. Or maybe if you took it, you would really have to stretch it, right? But it may be put in terms where it's not defaming anyone, but it's still hate speech.
Yeah. Britt, we're getting towards the end of our time, but as an avid football, which means soccer fan, I can't let you go without asking one final question. Is it warranted for me to hate another team? I want you to say yes. I mean, especially if it's a team whose players cheat and their fans endorse it. I won't name names, but surely it's rational for me to hate that team. What do you think, Britt?
I think that no.
I know you're right. I know you're right, and you're right about everything else as far as I can tell. And I hope that your proposals are adopted and that we enter a better period for our country and for the world. Thank you so much for joining us today, Britt.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest has been Barrett Brogard, professor of philosophy at the University of Miami and author of Hatred, Understanding Our Most Dangerous Emotion. So Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, that discussion of hatred in the US was really deep and horrifying, and I'm ready to go watch some classic movies and relax. So I'm gonna watch movies about couples who hate each other, like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and like Closer. I wouldn't want to live any of those stories. I don't want to live any kind of hate story, but I do love the snappy dialogue.
Yeah, have fun relaxing with those, Ray. Those are great suggestions. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and you can gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now, a man who's got no time for hate. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, maybe it's just me, but actual hatred is always going to be a fleeting thing. I can hate my mom because she won't give me a quarter for the movies, but then she does, and I love her again, with tears of gratitude, even if I wind up hating the movie. Hatred is rare, but intense. When Iago says to Othello, "I hate the Moor," for instance, I don't think he does. It could be simple racism, I suppose, which is focused hatred as a kind of targeted hobby. But in Iago's case, I think his hatred is an attempt to attach a recognizable human emotion to a psychotic whim, thus giving us the tragedy of Othello, which ironically many people love. Thinking about this, I've tried to remember if I've ever felt hatred. I don't think so. It seemed like hatred. It was usually extreme anger, once at a friend who had made me so angry I was trying to kill him by smashing his head against a tree. Fortunately, we were 11. He was extremely wiry, and I had no upper body strength. A week later, we were friends again. Growing up, as a wannabe liberal, I never quite worked up hatred for Reagan or Bush. Dick Cheney, maybe, Stephen Miller, but even there, it's on me. And liberals wind up hitting their own much more than conservatives. It was, hey, hey, LBJ, how many men you killed today? Not, hey, hey, Richard Nixon. I mean, where do you even go with that? And now, of course, as everybody and his dog, except for conservatives, want to embrace the Me Too and Black Lives Matter and woke culture, hatred is just uncool. If we hate, we need to work on our relationship skills. Everybody is trying desperately to be reasonable. President Trump seems to be the last hater in America, but it could just be the holding of grudges, not quite the same thing. He seems obsessed with Hunter Biden, though I don't quite see why, because his dad maybe helped him get a job 10 years ago, a job that he doesn't even have anymore. And frankly, when it comes to children riding on dad's coattails, a little healthy self-hatred might come in handy for Donald Trump. Any one of his kids, if you're honest about it, if they ate at your restaurant, you'd tell them cash only and count the forks when they left. No hater, just common sense. Trump also seems to hate Kamala Harris. He called her a monster when in fact she's a senator. I thought he liked senators. It was the House he pretended to hate. Trump also called Kamala Harris a communist. We do not have those either. We have also run out of hate as a nation. Where do we put it? The Cold War is over. Russia's just Putin's playground. China, we don't even know what China is right now. Another damn marketplace, near as I can tell. Here in California, what with fires and COVID, we don't have the breath or the personal space for hatred. However, some people hate having to wear masks. Some people hate people for not wearing masks. Hate can be a word we use when we don't have the right one. Do racists really hate black people? Or is it some kind of performative anti-virtue signaling to white people they'd like to have a beer with? Are all these hatreds equivalent? Cancel culture and woke are the same? Wake up, sheeple, and quit saying sheeple. I hate that. Do I hate Soviet death camps as much as I hate Jordan Peterson? Which do I hate more, figs or broccoli? It's a sliding scale. We don't all hate Nazis. Nazis love Nazis. That's how baby Nazis are made. I hated a vending machine once until my Snickers fell down. And Judge Judy, just the other day, a woman is suing her former boyfriend for the money she loaned him to fix the bumper of his car. She looked mad. She looked like she hated him. But all she wanted, as it turned out, was her $300 back. Judge Judy agreed. All hatred suddenly vanished. We love you, Judge Judy. And if you don't love Judge Judy, you're probably a communist or the equivalent and should be shunned or hated. Whatever. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I do not like that man, Ted Cruz. I do not like his backward views. I do not like his stupid suits. I do not like his cowboy boots. I do not like him when he sneezes. I do not like him eating cheeses. I hate to see his dumb face smirking because his beard looks like a merkin.